Blog Talk Radio.
Inaugural episode here on Suspense Radio called Crime and Science Radio, going to be hosted by DP Lyle and Jan Burke, and this is where you're going to hear everything crime and science, and it is going to be outstanding. So now, without any further ado, let's get it going here with our hosts, DP Lyle and Jan Burke.
Hello, everyone. This is Doug Lyle, DP Lyle, and I'm here with my dear friend, Jan.
Hi, this is Jan Burke. I'm going to welcome you all to a program that's going to explore forensic science and police procedure. We'll be looking at it past, present, and future. We'll talk to forensic scientists, detectives, attorneys, and others, and we're going to go over a wide variety of topics. We'll be interviewing successful writers about how they research and then how they use what they've learned in their research in their writing. And we're also going to be talking about forensic science news and cases of interest. And we'll tell you what you can do to improve forensic science in the U.S.
Also improve your stories. That, you know, Jan and I have talked about doing this for years, and I'm glad we finally got it off the ground with John's help. And, you know, the whole goal here is to teach you some stuff about forensic science and how it works in the real world, and also how you can use it in your stories if you're a crime writer, and make things real and not make those mistakes that you run across all the time.
Absolutely. So just for starters on this episode, we wanted to talk about Hollywood and forensic science and what they get right and what they get not so right. And the importance of doing this is because, of course, most of us already have a set of preconceived notions about how forensic science works, what crime scenes look like, and how investigations are handled. And unfortunately, most of those notions are wrong because they come from watching hours of television and seeing films. And even if you've studied some of this stuff or researched it otherwise, those images get in your head and stick there, and you start to believe that's the way it is. You think you know what a lab is like, and unless you've actually seen one, I'm going to guess most people probably don't. So let's talk about the fact that these dramas are meant to just be dramas. They're not meant to be documentaries. They're trying to tell a story, and that's what they focus on, is telling a dramatic story. And there's a good side to them, because there are those in the forensic science community who complain about shows like CSI and NCIS and Bones and others, but most of them know that the public fascination with forensic science has brought about benefits to labs as well. The public is much more aware of it. Doug, I don't know if you remember in the OJ case when the jury just had a glazed look on its face when they were talking about DNA.
Exactly.
Right.
And then when the Scott Peterson case came along, all they wanted was, well, where's the DNA? Where's the DNA?
Right.
And, of course, DNA was worthless in that case. But I think you're right on. I think the best thing you said there for me personally was you said don't assume. And I think we all have assumptions for what we know is true, whatever arena you're trying to research and look into. And our assumptions are often wrong, because most of what we learn in life is not in school and not from professionals. It's by hearsay and innuendo. And so you can get yourself in trouble as a crime writer if you use rumor and innuendo to bolster your facts. CSI, you know, for all its warts, really has, as you said, opened the public's eyes on things. And I think the thing to remember is that it is entertainment at the end of the day. And to me, they often make things that are very, very rare seem very, very common, and the reason is that that's glamorous. Most of forensic science in the real world is mundane. It's done by scientists who are who are humorless and hard workers and very dedicated individuals, but they're not like what you see on television.
Right. I think, you know, the shows that you might see something a little closer, if you watch something like Forensic Files or The First 48, some of those shows are more reality-based, but even then you may be seeing something that caught a producer's eye because it was odd and exceptional. So those are
exactly
things to keep in mind.
And one of the things I should point out, I mean, you see on CSI, you see these crime scene investigators that I know we're going to talk a little bit more about. They end up doing everything. They carry weapons. They interview people. I've even seen them treat the injured. And there's a very simple reason for that, as we'll get into, is that in a major crime scene, there may be 20, 30 people there doing all
right.
kinds of stuff that we're going to talk about. And on television, you can't do that. If you got 30 people in a scene, it becomes muddy. I mean, it becomes a chaotic situation. So they collapse all those jobs into a few people. So I'm always cutting them slack on the storytelling part as long as the viewer realizes it's entertainment.
Right. So let's go over some of the things that are different about crime scenes in reality than crime scenes on television. The very first thing is that police do not arrive with sirens blaring when they get a call saying there's a dead body in the house. If there's a dead body in the house, it's too late to arrive with a siren. Nobody needs to be hurrying in there. You know, it's a different case if you've got a suspect firing, you know, at officers or something like that, then yes, you want people to get out of your way so you can get to the scene. But if it's just a case where somebody said there's a bad smell coming from next door, you know, nobody arrives with, you know, sirens and lights. They just pull up and send in a patrolman to check it out. And that patrolman is going to see if there's anybody that's still alive or needs medical help there. But once that's ascertained in a jurisdiction where somebody's properly trained, the thing that happens is the scene is secured. And this is a thing that's very different in television. You'll see that just about anybody can apparently walk into a crime scene. One of the things that a good police force is going to do is to try to preserve whatever evidence is there. And since forensic scientists know that if you walk onto a scene, you bring something with you, you're going to, you know, everything leaves a trace, essentially, so at least some kind of evidence. So you don't want everybody in their size 12s walking over the crime scene. You surely, I don't know about you, Doug, but I don't think too many police departments hand out jackets that say Ryder on the back.
Richard Castle.
Right. So they control the scene, they separate witnesses, and the CSIs are not the first people through the door. And so they're not going to be wearing bulletproof vests, and in most jurisdictions they're not going to carry guns because they're not having any expectation of being attacked. The scene is secure at that point. The you know, homicide detective is in charge. And that's another major one. I'm sure you've seen this too, Doug, that the homicide detective is the person in charge of the case. So you're not going to let a CSI interview witnesses and suspects.
Exactly. Remember, what's going to happen is there's going to be a situation. And that situation is going to call an alarm to someone. And they're going to call it in. So a police officer is going to show up, him and his partner maybe. And they're going to approach cautiously because, remember, it's foreign territory to them. And they don't know if there's an armed suspect. They don't know what's going on. And then they're going to make sure, as Jan said, that everybody in there is indeed dead if there's a body. And they may approach the body and make sure that they're dead. They might even pull a wallet out for ID. But after that, they should back away. They should also be very careful with the scene. Blocking off, their primary responsibility at that time is to protect the scene and to try to detain any witnesses or anyone who has anything to say. The homicide detectives then take over that part of it. The CSI people, remember, they're scientists. They come in to collect bits of evidence. That's what they're there for. That's all they do. And they're
right.
trained in doing that. And so make sure that your CSI folks are doing what they're supposed to be doing, that the police are doing what they're supposed to be doing. And everybody, they have different areas of responsibility. We see those blended so much in television and novels and everywhere, and that's not the way it works in the real world. So try to keep those jobs separate at the crime scene.
Right. Now, a few other things about the crime scene. Let's just go through the senses here, a couple of big senses. They smell. They smell bad. So if you are writing crime fiction, this is something, again, it always is good to appeal to a reader's senses. And the sense of smell is a key one in any crime scene. You never see anybody wrinkle their nose in one of these shows. The other thing is they come in carrying pen lights as if they weighed 50 pounds up over their shoulders. Crime scenes aren't dark. They may start out dark, but when they're being processed by a CSI and law enforcement, they light that baby up. They bring out everything they can to get it as bright as possible. They'll come back in daylight if it's, you know, too dark otherwise. But they are definitely going to do everything they can. The only time you would have a light out at a crime scene being processed by CSIs would be if somebody's using luminol and they want to see if there's, say, biological material on a bedspread, which, you know, if you saw what happens in the average hotel room, you'd start bringing your own sheets. But so that's one of the things that happens too. These aren't dark. The inside of the lab isn't dark. We'll get to more about the lab in a minute. You'll see sometimes there'll be bones of skeletons. Skeletons are not white, generally speaking, unless they've been out in the desert sun or bleached by that process. They do not miraculously hold together like the one you saw in Mr. Johnson's science class in eighth grade. That guy had wires holding him together. But the average human being doesn't have those wires, and so their tendons, as they decompose, the bones fall apart. And a body left above ground in a wilderness area, that's probably not going to be whole for very long. The jawbone's not going to stay on. The bones will kind of collapse, and they won't be laid out.
And the predators will appear.
Exactly. Yeah,
they're always
some
looking
kind of
for
scavenger.
Food.
Right, some kind of scavenger is going to take it. Blowflies are going to be on the body before it hits the ground, but that's another whole set of topics. And as Doug was saying earlier, crime scene work is slow, methodical work. They don't just gather evidence. They have to catalog it, and they have to be very precise about where at the scene that evidence came from. So they're measuring, finding reference points, you know, fixed places from which you can say this was 3 feet from X or Y or whatever. They're looking not just down on the ground, but up and all around them on the walls and so forth.
One of the large issues is, what is evidence? And what's the flotsam and jetsam of life? Especially in public scenes, open scenes, scenes that are out in rural areas, not just enclosed in someone's living room or someone's bedroom or an enclosed apartment. That's critical too, but in public areas and in outdoor areas, is that paper wrapper from McDonald's, is that evidence or is that just trash? Well, how do you know when you're there trying to work a crime scene? And this is incredible fodder for fiction writers, because that thing that someone picks up that seems like it's unimportant may be the red herring, or it may be the clue that solves the crime down the road. That's not only true in fiction. That's true in real life. So the hair and the fiber and the crumpled paper and the empty beer can and the footprint and the bits of dirt and whatever that you find at the crime scene, some of it's just the flotsam and jetsam of life and trash, and some of it is make or break the case. And it's very difficult, and that's why these people have to be extremely methodical in their approach to this. They can't just come in willy-nilly. Oh, isn't that cute? Oh, maybe this is important. They have a process that they go through and when they approach a crime scene and they collect evidence, and it makes or breaks the case how they handle that scene.
Right, and as you're saying here, also, DNA is not always meaningful. There are sometimes reasons, perfectly legitimate reasons, for someone's DNA to be in place.
Sure.
Someone who is a convicted felon has a legal right to smoke a cigarette outside a liquor store. If that store is later robbed, simply finding that person's DNA on a cigarette butt in the ash can outside does not mean that was the person that did the robbery in a home.
Yeah, an example was the Lacey Peterson case, the Scott Peterson case. I remember I was on court TV once, and Catherine Cryer asked me, what about the DNA? And I said, what about it? It doesn't mean anything. They live together. They're married. So if there was a spot of Lacey's blood on Scott's blue jeans, so what? I could give you 20 innocent explanations for that. But that's what evidence does. It makes a connection, but then it's got to be explained what that connection is. And is that a connection that is, uh-oh, or is it a connection that says, yeah, so what?
Right, and it's not always easy to find DNA and fingerprints on, say, curved objects like guns. You're unlikely to lift it off a bullet or, you know, shell casing. There's a miraculous level of being able to find great prints on most of these shows. That really is not how it works. Let's see, what else? We don't have people usually working in high heels and sexy outfits. They rarely drive Hummers. Of course, they're not making Hummers now, but in the original versions, you know.
Exactly.
We talked about the bulletproof vest. I have to say that no one in their right mind sticks a fingertip into an unknown liquid and then tastes that liquid. That doesn't happen among real scientists.
Interesting, and, way back in the history of medicine in medieval times, it was how you diagnosed diabetes, because you'd taste the urine, and if it was sweet, you knew. Nobody would do that now.
No, it's not going to happen in modern times.
No, it's not.
And you're especially not going to say, oh, yes, it's blood. Yeah, you're in trouble if it is. But
they take that bag of white powder and get a little and snort it and say, oh, it's okay. No, you're not going to do that. Please.
So sort of segueing into the next thing we wanted to talk about, I'll also say, and this is huge on these shows, CSIs do not handle the body. That's against the law. So, Doug, you know, maybe you can talk a little bit more about who does handle the body and who does have the right to check its wallet and so on.
Yeah, well, at the crime scene where there is a body. When the police arrive, I mean, obviously the first thing they have to do is the protect and serve part, and they protect themselves, number one. So they make sure that the scene is secured. Now, will they maybe trample some evidence while they're doing it? Of course, but they have to make sure that the building, the room, the apartment, the house is clear. They have to look into every room, because the last thing they want to do is be standing there talking on the phone to the detective, telling the story, and get shot in the back by the guy hiding in the closet. Okay, we understand that. And the body, they're going to make sure the body is indeed dead. They're going to check for a pulse, usually at the neck. That's the best place, but it depends on the body. They might pull a wallet out if there's one in the back pocket, and they can do it easily and say, you know, this is Mr. Jones. But they might not. But at that point in time, the body, the crime scene belongs to the police, but the body belongs to the coroner, medical examiner. And so either that person will show up or one or two of his techs will show up. They will then take control of the body. They will examine it. They will remove any trace evidence that they see. If there's hair and fiber on the body, they may reduce in conjunction with the CSI people or of themselves. But then they will wrap the body and transport the body to the coroner's office or wherever the autopsy is being done. Now, this varies greatly from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Now, remember, the medical examiner coroner is the guy responsible for all things death, which means he politically and governmentally oversees at the county level the signing of death certificates to determine the cause and the manner of death and all of those things. That's his job. He will do whatever is necessary to do that job or not. He's got budgetary requirements and a lot of other things that go into it. Now, there's a huge difference, supposedly, between medical examiners and coroners. A medical examiner should be someone with medical training, hopefully a pathologist, hopefully a forensic pathologist. That's not always the case. the coroner, you would think, would be someone medically trained. That's not always the case. With either one, it depends upon the system that the county has adopted. And then how do you get that position? You're usually either elected or you're appointed. You're elected by the people of the county, or you're appointed by the county commission or the board of supervisors or whatever you call it in that jurisdiction. And if you're setting your story in a rural area in Iowa and it's a real county, it would be a good idea to go online and find out what system they have before you get egg on your face. But at
Absolutely.
The end of the day, these people don't have to have medical training. They don't have to be capable of doing their jobs. And I think that's critical and great fodder for fiction. They basically need to reside in the county, be of a certain age, and have a pulse, and then be electable or appointable. Probably they can't have a criminal record, but that's probably negotiable. So at the end of the day, Floyd the barber could be Mayberry's coroner. They could just appoint him and say, hey, you're the... In many jurisdictions, it's the pathologist or another doctor at the hospital, or it's the undertaker. Why? Because they're used to handling dead bodies. But it doesn't mean, I mean, you know, I've seen a lot of dead bodies in my career. I'm a physician. I would be a terrible medical examiner because I don't know that arena. Well, Floyd the barber knows less about it than I do, so I can't imagine how bad he would be.
Right. I think this is the number one problem right now in the U.S. in forensic science, personally, is that many of these coroners are not required, in some jurisdictions, are not required to have any training at all. In some places, like Texas, it's the justice of the peace who is not even someone necessarily legally trained. That's an administrative position that can be held by pretty much anybody who gets elected or appointed to it. So there's such a wide discrepancy in the requirements between places across the United States. As you were saying, it literally can be Floyd the barber. I know of a jurisdiction where a horseshoer is the coroner. So, you know, and even the ones who are doctors are not necessarily
right.
People who have any kind of training in pathology, and certainly do not always have training in crime scenes and forensic approaches to pathology. So,
and this goes right to the heart of CSI. I mean, the original CSI started in Las Vegas, and I've been over and spent the day at the lab there, and the medical examiner, the coroner there, they have a coroner system. The coroner system is a homicide detective. He had 30 years as a homicide detective. Great guy, very smart, very personable, very good at what he does. But he has absolutely zero medical training. So how does he get around it? He has four deputy assistant coroners that are forensic pathologists. They're trained in that. So they do the medical aspects. But at the end of the day, they report to him. And he's the guy at the top of the food chain who fills out or signs all the reports or is responsible for all the reports. If it goes to trial and it goes to court, it's his responsibility to either show up himself or have one of them or one of his techs or whoever show up there. In my hometown of Huntsville, Alabama, the coroner is a undertaker, which is an extremely common circumstance. But they have a forensic science center there, and there are two board-certified forensic pathologists there who do the medical work, which brings up another issue. With your coroner or medical examiner, besides being a curious guy who wants to do all this stuff, he's got a budget. He's not going to do an autopsy on everybody. And remember, he's just got to determine the manner of death, the cause of death, hopefully the time of death. And he will do what's necessary. Now, if someone gets hit by a train, he really doesn't have to do a whole lot. But under other circumstances, an autopsy is absolutely critical. Is he going to do it? Maybe. What if his budget? What if he doesn't have any money? He's not going to do it. He can get by with it because he lives in a town of 5,000 people. Who's going to say otherwise? Or he's inept, or he's corrupt, or he's involved in the murder. Great stuff for fiction.
Well, the other thing that also happens is in those small towns, he may know the family and
right.
May feel pressure not to state the true cause of death. We also have coroner's offices where there's no refrigerator to store bodies. there's no permanent office. I've heard of these folks having to have their offices, say, over a bridal shop in one case mm-hmm. in Arkansas, where, you know, you can imagine the bereaved family having to walk past the wedding party on their way to, you know, talk to the coroner, you know, and record keeping being very disjointed. So what it means ultimately is we don't always know. It has ramifications beyond even crime fiction. You know, you can look at what the public health and safety repercussions are huge.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I haven't heard that one. I like that one. often the autopsies are done at the local hospital, you know, and often by the pathologist on staff there in some cities. And he's not trained in forensic pathology, but he's trained in clinical pathology, which is a whole different world. But at least they have the facilities there. Other places, they're done over at the funeral home before the embalming and the burial and all of that stuff is done. It can go 1,000 different ways. Be sure to check, and you're writing a story in a real place, what happens in that jurisdiction.
Absolutely.
And I would like to remind everybody that we are going to take a short break, and we will be back in just a couple minutes here with more on Crime and Science Radio. So enjoy. So I want to welcome everybody back here to our next segment on Crime and Science Radio. And here again are your hosts, D.P. Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome back. We were talking about the coroner and the medical examiner and the issues that surround that. And Jan, you were making some observations about the corruption and some other things that can go on in these situations because of budgetary requirements and a lot of other things.
Right. I mean, one of the things that we know is that people get these appointments quite often because they help to get someone on the County Board of Supervisors elected. It's sort of a political plum. In some areas, they even determine whether it will be a Democrat or a Republican who will hold that office depending on who's in power in the county. So it's subject to so many different variations. You really want to check that out. The other thing that happens is the people who are undertakers who become coroners, some are just very kind, hardworking people who give people a sheet saying, here are all the other morticians in the area. Some are not quite so above board, and they use this as a way to sort of capture business. You know, as we're saying, oh, you're here, I just happen to have a casket for sale, might as well not have to pay for transportation costs to the guy down the street. So those are just some of the things that can happen. There's also quite often you'll see cases of theft where people working for coroner's office, this is something you can work in a story as well, where there's someone who's working for the coroner's office, handles the body. If he's a low-paid individual, he may decide to help himself to the victim's jewelry box or whatever's under the mattress on his way out the door.
Or the ring on the corpse's finger, which could be a critical clue in the entire case. And,
right.
Yeah, good stuff for storytelling.
It's also a good thing if you're going to have somebody go missing, have them go missing in one of these underfunded areas because they're not going to have protocols for keeping biological samples. They're going to cremate or bury that person without a whole lot of identifying information in some cases.
Yeah, and another thing to remember with that, you know, we all think that, okay, how are you going to identify a body? Well, there's dental records and there's DNA and there's fingerprints. Okay, that's great. What are you going to compare it against? If you don't have anything to compare those things against, then you can't make an identification. And so if you get, say, dental records on, let's say you get the fingerprints and you run them through a system and nothing pops up, just means the person's not in the system. It doesn't mean they're not a criminal, but it just means they're not in the system. But if you get dental records, how do you know whose dental records to check it against? So what the police often do, obviously, is they go to missing persons reports and in the area, and maybe then spread out from there. You know, if this is an 18-year-old, first-year college student that went missing, then they're going to look for people of that age, that sex, that size, that hair color, that whatever, and they're going to say, who's missing? And then they're going to start looking around and maybe compare those records. When you have only skeletal remains, it changes a lot. Because you can get maybe general size and you can get the sex if you have an intact skeleton and a few other things, but you can't, you don't know hair color if the hair's not there, it's been gone. You don't know eye color, you don't know a lot of things. And so identifying skeletal remains becomes a huge, huge problem and can be extremely expensive. And as Jan pointed out, in small jurisdictions that don't have a big budget, all this stuff just evaporates.
Exactly.
You got nothing. Yep. So
right.
After you get this, after we collect the body and we collect all the evidence, we move all of this stuff, and the focus of the crime scene actually turns to the crime lab now. And that's another whole area of great fodder for fiction and a place where magic happens and magic doesn't happen.
Right. I have to say that I'm sorry to report to you that labs are not high-tech palaces.
They don't have plasma screen TV?
No. And no holograms in any of the ones I've been in anyway. There's no such thing as the Jefferson Institute that you see on Bones. That would be a lovely thing to have. But so far, no one has set out billions of dollars to build this forensic anthropology palace. Forensic anthropologists are actually often physical anthropology professors who volunteer their time at the request of law enforcement or of a coroner or ME, and most don't have their own buildings. Their university may allow them some space to work in. They may have some room at a coroner's office if the coroner has an office or the ME has an office where they can do some work. I've never seen one with supercomputers or holographic displays.
Not even close.
There are a few new labs that have been built in the last decade or so, but most labs are housed in buildings that used to be something else. They're not purpose-built. They're often given some, I've seen them in literally in storage areas in a police department. One of my favorite things that happened regarding CSI was a friend of mine who believed that the lab she was seeing on that show was the actual Las Vegas lab at the time, and this was in the early years of the show. And at the time that show started out, the Las Vegas lab was having to rent space in a building. It didn't even have its own facility. So I will say that the producers of that show have been generous to the people of Las Vegas and have helped them build some better facilities since then. But it is not the usual case in most jurisdictions.
They're usually people who sit in cinder block buildings that are painted
mm-hmm.
goopy green
mm-hmm.
or pale yellow, and they sit in dark rooms and they work with their gadgetry. Computers that are outdated, software that is outdated, equipment that is outdated, and they labor in these labs trying to do the chemistry and the microscopics and the ballistic examinations, firearms examinations, the DNA processing, and they often do it under great duress and with not the best equipment. Example,
right.
One of the questions I get asked most often by writers is, well, how long does it take to get a DNA thing back, just for instance?
Well, if you're on CSI, it takes 33 seconds. But in reality, first of all, I should point out that in most forensic science labs, which do have better lighting than the ones, that is the one thing they have better lighting than the labs in CSI are under these blue lights sometimes. But you can have 2 to 10 people working on a single DNA sample because there's this long, tedious process of separating the sample out from whatever it's on or whatever it's mixed with, for one thing. There's a whole lot of paperwork that every buddy working in a forensic lab has to deal with. The backlogs, it depends on the jurisdiction. This is something you really want to check out. What's the situation in your local jurisdiction? The reality for most labs is that crimes are being solved out there by 19th century methods. It's by detectives.
Exactly.
Going around, asking question after question, getting somebody... If you watch shows, even something like the Forensic Files, if you pay attention, it often takes years for them to come up with a piece of evidence or figure out what's going to be significant out of everything they've gathered. Most of these people are really just trying to be ready in time for trial. There are a few labs out there that are independent of police departments, but most are basically built into, they're not independent, they're built into the prosecutorial system. And the prosecutor, the DA, is looking for evidence to bolster their case, and they want the lab to finish their work in time for the case. That might be 6 months from when that sample was brought in, and at that point they may say, guess what, you've been holding the wrong guy all this time. So it can take a long time, and so if you're worried that in your case, well, they would have found this guy, and by the next day they would have known to eliminate him, that's really unlikely to be the case. High-profile case in a big metropolitan area, you might get a pretty fast turnaround. Doug, you can talk about it too. There's that gap between what's possible and what's happening.
And again, that's the complaint with the CSI program, is that they make the things that are fantastical, even though they're possible, seem very commonplace. You know, how fast can you run a DNA profile? If you've got a good sample, I mean, with the really most state-of-the-art modern equipment, you know, hour or two, you can get a profile. You can compare it to other profiles. That doesn't happen in the real world. That doesn't happen ever in the real world. Now, fortunately, 90% of murders occur between people who know each other and have a connection and a reason, and I guarantee you 75-80% of the time, the cops know in an hour who did it. The rest of the story is, how do you prove it? So there's always this rush to judgment. No, it's not. It's common sense. You know, the wife killed the husband, or the husband killed the wife. I mean, that's what happens in the real world. The rest of it is proving it. So if you have a high-profile case, sure, you maybe it's in a jurisdiction, you've got all this stuff, but you're not going to find the medical examiner running out and reporting that. He's not going to file his final thing. What he's going to do is he's going to rework it. He's going to take his time. He's probably going to farm it out to a one or two other labs to let them corroborate his evidence. And so now you've got at least weeks that go by. And then they play these things very close to the vest. Use that in your story, that delay. And so they say, well, he could have done this in an hour. No, you really, it's not going to happen in the real world that way. It just takes longer than that.
Right. And the other thing that you see in these programs often is that one person has 10 specialties under their belt. They can be a forensic entomologist and a firearms expert and a toxicologist and process DNA. And as you said, because you can't have a cast of thousands in these shows, you do have to narrow it down. But in real life, this is going to be handled by a variety of individuals who have specialties. They're getting not one case thrown at them at a time. They're getting hundreds of them thrown at a time, and most of them are overwhelmed and have huge, huge case lists. Remember, they're not just handling murders. They're also getting DUIs and thefts and other kinds of rapes.
And, of course, the other side of the coin, if you're in a small area, a rural jurisdiction, you'll have maybe a police officer who is handling the fingerprint stuff. And he may even be doing the blood spatter analysis because he read a book on it. And he may be doing hair and fiber because he read a book on it as a microscope. And that's all they got. And that's all they can afford. And so that does happen in the real world. But those people aren't qualified to do any of that stuff in the first place.
Right. They should be sending it into the FBI lab or some other resource, a regional lab, but that doesn't always happen. You know, people can decide they're going to handle it on their own. Another thing I wanted to talk about is, this is a staple of many science shows. You see it in science fiction shows as well as in forensic science fiction shows, which is this mega database that has everybody in it. And they have a computer that always finds a match. I mean, everybody they run DNA on is encoded.
With their picture, right there on the screen.
Right, their picture, and they've stayed in the jurisdiction, and you have a photograph of them and a present address, as you said, you know, all showing up within seconds. You have these mega computers that can analyze and find all kinds of bizarre information. You know, oh, this person bought a Persian rug just the other day. I can instantly pull up his credit reports or whatever. You know, it's not that police can't eventually get warrants to get some of that information, but they can't get all of it. On the other hand, there's also a whole lot of stuff. You should not trust the science in these shows. While most of them, not all, but most, do try to present some kind of realistic science, you have to be aware that at any time a producer can decide that they want something new in there, or a writer can just make something up out of whole cloth. So you're not going to be able to find computers that analyze voices and identify them as an individual in real life. The FBI does not have something that does that. You can't pour rubber into a stab wound on a body, let it set, pull it out, and see what the killing knife looked like. This is impossible. Tissue doesn't just freeze in place like that. It actually, all kinds of things, as Doug could tell you, keep happening to it even after death. So
that's called
those
decay.
Are, yeah, those are just a couple. Exactly. You know, the body starts eating itself in a whole lot of ways.
Exactly.
But you don't want to assume that because you saw something on television that this is a possibility. You want to take the time to do real research and find out, is this something that actually can happen? Because some of your readers will be sharp enough to know that. You know, just like we caught CSI at this kind of stuff.
And one other thing that's a kind of a pet peeve of mine, and I don't want any of you out there to make this mistake, there's a rule in medicine. Dead folks do not bleed.
Mm.
Okay, once your heart stops and the blood quits flowing, you're going to stop bleeding. There may be a little blood left, and it may be gravity may have some of it ooze out for a couple of minutes, but then it's going to start clotting very quickly. And the clotting time for blood is anywhere from 5 to 10 minutes or so, and by then it's clotted. But it's going to start clotting very quickly, and if there's no driving force, such as the circulation of the blood by the heart, the body will stop bleeding. And so don't have your guy come by 20 minutes later and see blood still trickling out of some wound. It's not going to happen that way. And I've read it a lot. I've seen it on TV a lot. It's very dramatic when it's visual, but it's not really the way it works.
Right. I just thought of another impossibility. I think everyone I know would love to have a computer that would show a security camera photo image and say the word enlarge to the computer and have it be able to do that without the pixels, turning everything into just a muddy, blurred image and never lose resolution. It's just fantastic what can be done with photographs on these shows that can't happen in real life.
In fact, it's a very laborious process. It was actually the Visar system, video imaging stabilization and registry system, was invented by a guy named Dr. David Hathaway, who is at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, and I actually met him, and I made him a character under another name in one of my books. But he invented the system, and he is the director of the solar imaging programs for NASA. He knows a little bit about imaging. It's a long, involved story. I won't go into it here, but he was given a 11-second about that video of an object against a park bench during the Atlanta Olympic bombings. And from that, he developed the Visar system along with his partner. It is a very, very laborious process that requires very sophisticated computers and people who know what they're doing, and you're not going to push a button and have it happen. Maybe one show we'll address that. Maybe I'll even get David to come on the show. He's a great guy. And we can talk about video imaging and stabilization. Great topic and great for crime fiction.
Another thing you need to be aware of is maybe just be aware of what the words forensic science mean. The forensic part comes from the court of law in which all of this has to be presented. And in real life, you can't invent some new method of doing something and take it into a courtroom the next day and convict someone. It has to be accepted by the scientific community. Some of you who may have watched the case recently in Florida, Trayvon Martin's, you may recall that there are some things that people wanted to try to have admitted, and even though those technologies had been around a little while anyway, there was hesitancy to accept them in the court because there are rules about what gets in and what doesn't, and there are standards. In fact, we're going to have Marcia Clark on in a few weeks, and we'll be talking more about all of this. But this is something else that's missing in these shows. Nobody ever has to go to court MIPPA
right.
stuff. And I have to tell you, between chain of custody and other issues, a lot of this stuff would never make it into a courtroom.
And a lot of it's making its way back out of the courtroom now. I'm sure
yes.
everybody remembers the Casey Anthony case and that tragic case, and you were probably sick of it as it went on forever. But it actually was a little milestone in forensic history because for the first time, electronic nose evidence, when they tested the air in the trunk for the molecules of decomposition. This has been worked on for a number of years, but this was the first time that it was actually allowed and admissible in a courtroom. And what that means is now there's precedent for it. And what that means is now it can be brought in again. It doesn't mean that it's not going to be thrown out later and overturned and found to be, quote, junk science, or it doesn't mean that it's not going to turn out to be good science. The end of the day is we just don't know yet. People lately have been attacking fingerprints. And I remember reading one case, and the judge finally came down and said, well, I really appreciate all your arguments, but if you show me two people with the same fingerprint, then I'll listen to what you have to say. But until then, I'm not going to listen to what you have to say. And he struck it down. But this is the kind of things that are going on out there in the real world. Each scientific technique, whether we know it's true, assume it's true, or hope it's true, may not be true at the end of the day. Our knowledge changes year by year by year. But right now, we got some pretty good stuff out there, and we got some other stuff that's a little suspect.
Right. And this is the nature of science. I mean, if you realize, just even in medicine, how things that we thought were true 15 years ago, we may not believe are true now. You know, so this is true also in this area of science as well. There's a huge thing going on now with hair and fiber evidence where, you know, this can sometimes happen. You know, when you're talking about Jerry Schmo, who's, you know, the injured officer who's been given the lab assignment, who's had no scientific training whatsoever, he gets up on the stand because he still has to testify, and he says something like, no one, you know, he hasn't had a statistics course, so he says no one could have this same hair, you know. This is absolutely unique to this individual. And the jury, which has been watching CSI and believes this kind of stuff, says, yeah, why not? You know, you must be right. Everything, the forensics, this is another part of the CSI effect, is that
sure.
people give a lot of weight to what a forensic scientist says. And that's great if the person actually has, you know, good credentials and really knows what they're doing, but that isn't always the case.
Which brings up a point that I think is important, is we talked about evidence in this whole program and what it is and how we collect it, and but what does evidence do? Evidence doesn't point the finger at anybody. It points the finger away from everyone else. And let me just give you a quick example. There is a brownish stain found on the carpet at a crime scene. The first question is, what is it? Is it blood, or is it ketchup, or is it chocolate sauce, or is it jelly? Well, they test it, and they determine, okay, it's blood. The next question is it human blood? Okay, so they test it, and they say, yes, it's human blood. So we've eliminated chocolate sauce and ketchup and dogs and cats. But every human, we got 7 billion suspects left. So now, what's the blood type? Well, okay, let's say it's AB negative, which is the rarest of blood types, and so that 3% about of the population has it. So now we've eliminated 97% of that 7 billion people. So now we go to DNA, and with DNA we can get it down to one person unless they have a twin. So now what you've done is you've excluded everyone else, and it goes back to the famous Sherlock Holmes thing, that once you have excluded everything else, the thing that is remaining, regardless of how preposterous it may be, must be the truth. Which brings us to, Jan, you have a wonderful program coming up for our next program. You want to tell everybody a little bit about that?
Sure. I'll be talking with Leslie S. Klinger, who is an amazing expert on Sherlock Holmes. So it'll be a lot of fun because we get to talk about Sherlock Holmes by someone who knows him better than anybody I know, anyway. And Les is the author of The Annotated Sherlock Holmes, and he's soon actually teaching a course at UCLA in Holmes and His World. So he's got a tremendous background on all this. And one of the reasons we wanted to talk about it is Holmes, did that influence forensic science? Where was forensic science at the time the Sherlock Holmes stories were started? So it's going to be a lot of fun. And it'll also give us a chance to talk about forensic science in the past. I know some of you are writing historical stories, so that will give you a chance to take a look at resources and finding out a little bit about what it may have been like in Victorian times to be looking at evidence in the way Sherlock Holmes did. How did he influence, how did Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's stories influence real-life investigation. So I think it'll be a lot of fun to talk to Les about all of that.
And I'm really looking forward to it. Well, I think this wraps up our first show, and I know we've had a good time, and I hope all you out there have had a good time, and we'll be doing this twice a month, and I hope you'll tune back in. And Jan, always a pleasure.
It's a pleasure, Doug, and we will have links on our website for the show to for those of you who want to know more about some of the topics we talked about.
And everybody, that wraps up the first episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio. And those links they were talking about, if you go to suspensemagazine.com, you will see on the right-hand side a banner for Crime and Science Radio. You can click on that banner or simply put in suspensemagazine.com/crimeandscienceradio.html to be taken directly to the site to see exactly which episodes are coming up, at what times they're coming up. September 21st at 10 a.m. is going to be the Sherlock Holmes show. October 5th is going to be the show after that. And then October 19th, you'll be able to see D.P. Lyle and Jan Burks and their websites and all their information. So check out everything that has going on there on Crime and Science Radio by going to suspensemagazine.com, either clicking on the box of the link or going to crimeandscienceradio.html. If you have any questions about any episodes or any clarifications about anything, please email us here at radio@suspensemagazine.com. For all the information, we'll make sure we get it to the host. We'll get everything over to you. And it was great to be able to have Doug and Jan on the inaugural show here of Crime and Science Radio. Thank you, everybody. And we will see you for Sherlock Holmes, September 21st. Goodbye. Thank you.